From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, corporate greed, abuse, and waste in the rebuilding of Iraq. We talk with T. Christian Miller about his new book, Blood Money. He's an investigative reporter for the LA Times. One of the stories he'll tell is how the contract to handle security at the Baghdad airport went to a new company that had no experience in security, no weapons, not even an accountant. Miller says it's just one example of how companies exploited the chaos in Iraq and the lack of planning in Washington. Also, celebrating the Santa Fe Opera's 50th anniversary, Lloyd Schwartz talks about his trip to see the operas and remembers his first visit to the Santa Fe Opera over three decades ago. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The reconstruction of Iraq was supposed to show America at its best and improve the lives of the Iraqi people. But as the new book Blood Money points out, after more than 3 years, Iraqis have less electricity than under Saddam Hussein. Oil production is far below its pre-war peak. And there are outbreaks of easily preventable diseases like hepatitis. Blood Money is about the greed, waste, and fraud that have undermined the rebuilding of Iraq. My guest is the author, T. Christian Miller. He's an investigative reporter for the LA Times. Miller says the people who have profited from the billions poured into Iraq include a motley assortment of retired Republican operatives, U.S. businessmen, Iraqi exiles with dubious histories and doubtful motives, and massive U.S. corporations like Halliburton and Bechtel. In Washington, political appointees did their best to make sure friends got in on the action. Before we get into some of the specific stories of corruption, fraud, and waste, what was the ideal we were shooting for in the reconstruction of Iraq?
That's a great question, because after almost 3 years of covering that, I can't tell you, nor do I believe that any Bush administration official could tell you succinctly and clearly what the goal is for the reconstruction of Iraq. It changed over time from different people. After a morning of fishing in August of 2003, President Bush went before a group of reporters outside of Crawford, Texas, and told them that his vision was to make Iraq, to have the best infrastructure in the whole region. Fast forward 3 years and you get to the current head, or some of the senior officials in the reconstruction program, sort of meekly saying that the best we can hope for is to build a foundation upon which the Iraqis can build their own society, their own country. So you've never really had a clear statement of what it was that we were trying to achieve over there. That didn't stop them from spending $30 billion, but it did stop them from having a coherent vision.
Of the $30 billion that we've spent so far in the reconstruction of Iraq, how much of that money is unaccounted for or has gone to fraud and waste?
Well, nobody's going to be able to give you a figure on that, and that's partly due to the complexity of the spending that happened. There's two big pots of money in Iraq. One, which was Iraqi money, that is the revenue that did come from oil pumping mostly, and that was about $20 billion that we had responsibility for. And then there was $30 billion in U.S. taxpayer money. That's our money that you and I pay through taxes and flows over there. On the Iraqi side of the equation, there are literally billions of dollars which will never be accounted for. We just don't know how that money was spent or where it went or what happened to it at all. On the U.S. side of the equation, that $30 billion, that has been much more carefully tracked. And there have been numerous audits done that raise questions about hundreds of millions, tens of millions in different projects and different portions. But the corruption and fraud and waste on the U.S. side of the equation appears to be less of an issue than it does on the Iraqi side of the money. Although we still bear responsibility for the Iraqi money that was we were spending, and it was in our wallets. But we seem to have been much freer in how we spent that money.
Your book, Blood Money, is filled with stories of corporate greed in Iraq. Let's start with one example, and this has to do with the cell phone system in Iraq. There wasn't a cell phone system in place under Saddam Hussein. Why not?
The cell phone system is one of the strangest chapters of the whole reconstruction. Saddam Hussein feared communications. He feared the free flow of information amongst his citizens, and so he had never installed a cell phone system, or much of a phone system at all, frankly, in Iraq. And so when the U.S. invades Iraq in March of 2003, they come upon a country which has no cell phone system at all, 26 million people. It was, as cell phone company executives call it, the world's last greenfield market, completely exploitable, completely ready for a system to be installed. Because Saddam Hussein had not installed a cell phone system because of that communications issue, it became one of the primary the first priorities of the U.S. occupation government to get a cell phone system up and running so that ordinary Iraqis could talk to each other, so that businessmen could get business flowing, so that Iraqis could call their police forces, their military, the U.S. military, to report any sort of insurgent activity or other dangerous situations. So it really was one of the top priorities of the first year in Iraq.
And how are the different companies angling to get themselves the contract?
It was really a free-for-all. At the time, you have to keep in mind, in sort of the summer of 2003, Iraq was still relatively peaceful. And so it was this billion-dollar marketplace, and everybody wants to get in there. And so you had companies like Lucent, companies like Qualcomm, trying, and Middle Eastern companies, Asian companies, European companies, all trying to get into that market. And so what the coalition government does is they say, well, we're going to auction off licenses. And they do that, and the process proceeds, and they end up awarding 3 cell phone licenses for all of Iraq. None of those 3 licenses goes to an American company. And that angers some individuals inside the Pentagon, in particular, an individual named Jack Shaw, who was then a deputy undersecretary of defense, a Rumsfeld appointee.
And you said that he was designated as the Pentagon's liaison to Iraq on telecom issues, even though he had no background in either defense contracting or telecommunications.
Yeah, Jack Shaw was a career political appointee. He'd served numerous Republican administrations. There was nothing that obviously qualified him for this job, except for the fact that one of his good friends was on the board of a company that was trying to get a cellular phone contract in Iraq. That company was shut out in the cell phone licensing auction, so they didn't get a license. They didn't have a phone system. So Shaw then spends the next year or so essentially trying to get this company, which is called Liberty Mobile or GuardianNet, it changes its name over time, trying to make sure that company gets a piece of the action in Iraq. And it's literally how they see it, a piece of the action. There's just all sorts of things he tries to do over there. He hectors the local people on the ground in Iraq to try and get them a cell phone contract. He tries to have a member of the company's board of directors appointed the Minister of Communications in Iraq. It's an endless saga that goes on and on for months and months. And essentially, he tries to steer one particular contract to this company, which on whose board one of his friends serves. And that whole effort ends up collapsing in March of 2004 when 2 whistleblowers on the ground in Iraq say, this is just ridiculous. We don't need this company here. We don't want them here. We don't need this sort of system here. You've got to back off.
Well, before we get to the whistleblowers, let's talk a little bit about what the plan was. One of the things he did, one of the things that Shaw did was to find a kind of backdoor way of getting the contract for his friend's company. And this was through the help of legislation that gave special preference to native companies, native corporations in Alaska. Would you describe what that legislation was?
Right. This is what I'm referring to when I talk about one of the strangest chapters, the Reconstruction. What happens is there are companies called Alaska Native Companies. Those are companies which are formed by Alaskan natives, that is tribal Alaskans. And they have special contracting privileges like many other minority groups do, but with one enormous exception. Most minority contract awards are limited in their size. But Alaskan Native corporations can receive any size contract, $1 billion, $2 billion, it doesn't matter. Another special feature of these corporations is they don't actually have to do the work, much of the work. There's some small percentage they're required to do, but they can win a big government contract worth $2 billion and then immediately subcontract out to a Lockheed Martin, let's say. And that's happened many times in the past. So it's sort of a scam that's a well-known industry, sub-industry within the government contracting world, that a big Native American corporation will get one of these set-aside, no-bid minority contracts, and then immediately hand it over to some other big corporation. In Iraq, the way that particular system plays out is that Senator Ted Stevens, who is the senior senator from Alaska and has always been very aggressive about protecting his constituents' interests, he inserts at the last minute into one of the Reconstruction bills, a special clause which specifically preserves those special contracting privileges the Alaskans have. You fast forward a couple months, and Jack Shaw seizes upon these no-bid contracts of any size, and what he essentially does is he connects an Alaskan Native corporation called Nana Pacific with his friend's corporation, which is called GuardianNet. And those two companies together then are going to get a no-bid contract, and that no-bid contract will then, as he puts it, morph into a cellular phone contract worth up to $1 billion for all of Iraq. And that is what the whistleblowers object to.
So how did the whistleblowers find out about this scheme?
Well, the whistleblowers were directly involved. They were sort of Shah was in Washington overseeing this whole process. And there was a phrase that the folks in Iraq had about Washington, which is it was the 8,000-mile-long screwdriver. The people in the Pentagon were back here kind of turning the screwdriver and trying to make things work in Iraq and not giving responsibility to the people on the ground in Iraq. And so the people on the ground in Iraq, a man named Dan Sudnick, who was in charge of the telecommunications effort in Iraq, he was basically watching all this occur and watching it get worse and worse and worse. And he finally had enough and tried to pull the plug on the whole process.
But he was smeared.
Oh, yeah. Jack Shah back here in Washington begins to spread rumors that Sudnick himself is corrupt and that his original cell phone licensing deal was a problem, although the inspector general investigated that and had cleared him. And he essentially, and Ted Stevens himself makes a visit over to Iraq at about this same time and sort of raises some issues as to why it is that, are there problems with contracts going to Alaska Native corporations? So Sudnick finds himself essentially abandoned, his name smeared, his reputation tarnished. He's summarily fired by the coalition, by then Ambassador Paul Bremer, who was in charge of the occupation government for the first year. He's put on a plane and sent home, and he struggles today to try and recover his reputation and his to clear his name, essentially.
So the way that Shah from the Defense Department gets this backdoor deal for his friend through partnering with an Alaska Native corporation, it's all legal. It is all legal. So what's the problem?
Well, yeah, it's all legal. It sounds comical, but it is all definitely legal. The problem was that, there's a couple problems. One, it wasn't what anybody in Iraq wanted. Nobody needed another cellular phone contract. Number two, the particular type of system that they wanted to install is a system widely unused in the U.S., but it's not used anywhere else in the world. So if you put the system in Iraq, nobody else would be able to use it, and it would basically force the Iraqis in the Middle East to go on the U.S. standard of cell phone communications, which would basically reward very much companies like Qualcomm, but wouldn't do very much for telecommunications in the Middle East. So that was the second thing. And the third thing, then, it was simply unseemly. It was a conflict of interest at the very least. And both the FBI and the Inspector General for the Pentagon both looked into this matter, although ultimately the FBI filed no charges in the case.
Now, you say that this scandal set back the telecommunications industry in Iraq. How?
What happened with, the cellular phone system itself continued apace, and it has grown, and it's actually one of the very few success stories of the reconstruction of Iraq, is that the cell phone system has grown and expanded, and so Iraqis today have cell phone communications. They're not great, but they have them. On the other side, the particular contract that was involved in this deal between the Alaska Native Corporation and the U.S. company involved police communications. It was a contract to allow communications between police systems, essentially. That whole effort collapses when Dan Sudnick leaves. And it's only now, almost 3 years later, that there is a 911 system which is up. But there was a recent Inspector General report, which got almost no attention, which essentially says that Iraqis today, 3.5 years later, still can't call their local police station. They still can't report an insurgent attack or an insurgent, even tip off the Iraqi army or military, because they still don't have an effective system of communicating both with their emergency centers, their first responder centers, and nor do those centers have an effective way of communicating with each other. So 3.5 years later, it's this amazing thing where we've put this focus on trying to tamp down the insurgency, and yet we still can't create a system that allows the Iraqis to call 911.
My guest is T. Christian Miller. His new book is called Blood Money. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is T. Christian Miller, an investigative reporter with the Los Angeles Times. His new book is called Blood Money, and it's about fraud, corruption, and waste in the reconstruction of Iraq. Let's look at another story that you document in your book, Blood Money, and this is the story of Custer Battles, a company that got millions and millions of dollars in security contracts in Iraq. The company was created by Scott Custer and Mike Battles. What was their experience and track record in security when they went to Iraq and started getting these contracts?
None, essentially. The bottom line is, or almost none. Scott Custer had done some work in private security consulting, and Mike Battles had been a CIA officer, had retired, and then had run for Congress as a Republican candidate in Rhode Island. And so in the fall of 2002, after Mike Battles loses that race, he and his friend, Scott Custer, their old buddies from the Army, are looking around for work, essentially. And one of the obvious opportunities is Iraq, as Iraq begins to slowly grind toward war. Only about a month after the invasion of Iraq, Mike Battles takes a taxi from Amman, Jordan. He's got $475 in his pocket, and he arrives in Iraq, which at the time is chaos. I call it like this, the cantina scene out of Star Wars. You've got contractors running around, you've got Iraqis running around, you've got government officials. Nobody knows what's going on. It's complete chaos. And into this chaos, Mike Battles arrives, and he hears and talk in the corridor that there's a need for a private security contractor out at the Baghdad airport. And so he essentially negotiates on the fly with a coalition official a contract to provide security at the airport, which, keep in mind, the airport is at this time the only way really in and out of Iraq to move large quantities of goods in and out of Iraq. So again, it's one of these very crucial jobs in Iraq. And within 2 months of arriving in Iraq, Custer Battles has an $18 million contract to provide protection and security in the airport in Iraq.
So you have two guys there who are promising to get the job done and get it done quickly, but with nothing to back that up.
Right. They had, in fact, as it later turned out, they didn't even actually have the money to hire people and to bring them over to Iraq. At the time they get hired, they have four or five employees. They have no weapons, and they're supposed to be a security firm. And they don't even have an accountant. They essentially have the advantage of being there, of being a body in front of a government official who's got a need to fill. And that's all it takes at that point in time to get a contract.
And then they got other contracts, too. What other contracts did they get?
Yeah, one of the more remarkable things about that story is that almost from the beginning, the government officials there, the guys who are supposed to be doing oversight for our money and the Iraqis' money, suspected something was wrong. Very, very early on, they weren't delivering needed supplies. They got a second contract, which was essentially to provide housing and internet services for other contractors who were involved in helping out Iraq's banking system. And though they weren't able to deliver trucks that were needed, according to the folks I talked to, they were delivering things late. And so very early on, the government was kind of suspicious of Custer Battles, but yet they kept winning contracts. They won this airport contract, then they won this food and housing contract. The CIA hired them to provide vehicles that were used in the hunt for Saddam Hussein and his family. And they just kept racking up work.
So how were they finally called out on this?
Well, there's again, it's the work of whistleblowers. Some of the whistleblowers who were involved with the airport contract early on report these problems, and the government at the time says, we can't deal with this right now. Their work is too crucial, too vital. We've got to put it aside. We just can't deal with this possible fraud. And it isn't until a year later, essentially, that the whistleblower's complaint surfaces to the Pentagon's contract officers. And the Pentagon's does an investigation and finds out that, you know, they don't really know where the money's going. And so almost a year to the day after they get their last contract, they have a suspension order, which essentially suspends all their work. They can't get any more government contracts. And from there then begins a criminal investigation, and then there begins a lawsuit against them as well. And this all culminates in a jury trial, in a civil jury trial, in which they're found guilty of fraud earlier this year. And then that gets recently overturned and is now on appeal. So the case is still out.
T. Christian Miller is an investigative reporter for the Los Angeles Times. His new book is called Blood Money. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from Universal Pictures, presenting The Black Dahlia, from the director of Scarface and the author of L.A. Confidential, The Black Dahlia, in theaters Friday. From Dell Books, publisher of The Sacred Cut, a modern mystery set in Rome by David Hewson, author of The Villa of Mysteries. And from TIAA Cref, serving the financial needs of those in the academic, medical, cultural, and research fields. Online at TIAACREF.org/greatergood. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, the hospitals in Iraq that never got built. We continue our interview with T. Christian Miller about waste and greed in the reconstruction of Iraq. Also, classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz tells us about going to New Mexico for the Santa Fe Opera's 50th summer season. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with T. Christian Miller, an investigative reporter for the LA Times. He's written a new book called Blood Money about the greed, waste, fraud, and bad planning that have undermined the rebuilding of Iraq. One of the things you write about is rebuilding hospitals. And in this, you give one example of how Laura Bush asked a friend from Texas, John P. Howe, to tour Iraq and make recommendations for improving the health care there. What did he recommend?
John P. Howe, who heads a charity called Project Hope, comes back from Iraq, and he has a vision that Iraq needs a children's hospital, a high-end children's hospital, that his charity, Project Hope, specifically will help to operate. They'll provide training and some of the equipment. And so he approaches Laura Bush with this idea, and she thinks and lends considerable weight and backing to this project, which evolves into being building a very high-end care facility for children in Basra in southern Iraq.
Did he stand to profit a lot from this hospital?
No, the charity wasn't. It's a charity, so it's a nonprofit organization. However, it certainly would have been a high-profile project if Iraq had developed into the shining beacon of democracy that the administration hoped that it would. The hospital would have obviously been trained. The people would have been trained by Project Hope, and Project Hope would have been able to fill it with equipment from some of its medical backers. So more than anything, it would have been a showcase for this charity.
Now, some experts in Reconstruction thought that this hospital was ill-advised. Why did they think that?
This was a question of health economics. There's no real debate that Iraq needs everything. A high-end hospital costing $50 million, Iraq doesn't have anything like that. It'd certainly be a good thing. It's a question of priorities. Iraq needs really fundamental things, and instead of a $50 million high-end hospital, that $50 million could have bought and saved the lives of many more children if that money had gone to such things as vaccinations, clean drinking water, even real basic health clinics spread throughout Iraq. Of course, that never happened either. But it was a question of priorities. Do we really need a hospital like this at a time when it's difficult to even make sure that electricity flows in a place like Basra, much less having a plastic surgery clinic?
So what happened to this plan for the hospital?
Well, if you go to today, 3 years later, the Inspector General for Iraq just released a report which essentially accused USAID, which is the U.S. Agency for International Development, of botching this project along with the chief contractor, which was Bechtel out of San Francisco. There's no hospital there. The $50 million has been spent. The project has been essentially abandoned by Bechtel. Bechtel has said they don't believe they can complete it at any cost. And USAID has been accused of some funny accounting to essentially hide the true cost of this still unbuilt, unfinished hospital in Basra.
Looking at the larger healthcare system in Iraq, you write that Parsons Corporation, which won the largest rebuilding, one of the largest rebuilding contracts, will finish only 20 out of 150 planned health clinics, and nearly $70 yeah. million dollars of medical equipment meant for the clinics, meanwhile, sits unused.
Yeah, again, with the best intentions, the U.S. was going to build health clinics and hospitals throughout Iraq. Parsons Corporation, which is in Pasadena, won that contract, and they just weren't able to deliver. Of the 120 to 150 health clinics that were supposed to be finished, completed, only 8 or 9 were actually finished and turned over to the Iraqis, and the rest of them will perhaps one day be finished. They've been turned over to local Iraqi contractors to do, but the money's running out. And so in the meantime, we have lots of medical equipment, which is sitting around moldering in a warehouse somewhere in Iraq. And we have a lot of walled-up health clinics that are now, instead of symbols of promise to the Iraqis in these different neighborhoods throughout Iraq, they're symbols of failure. And Iraqis will look at them and they'll point at them and say, "What? Why isn't this health clinic open? Why isn't it working? Where is all the money gone?" And that's a difficult question to answer.
You offer schools and education in general as the biggest success story during the U.S. Reconstruction of Iraq. What has made schools and education more successful?
I think the bar was kind of low, frankly. There was a lot of schools in Iraq already, and essentially what that program did was painting those schools and getting them up to basically improving the furniture and the desks and things like that. Bechtel, again, was given that job, which, when you think about it, hiring a world-class engineering company like Bechtel to paint schools in Iraq is like, you know, hiring Frank Gehry to design your tool shed. It just doesn't make much sense. You could have given those jobs to Iraqis rather than to a U.S. multinational. Nevertheless, the schools have been painted. And new textbooks have been provided, updated. I think one of the ironies with that particular project is that they haven't been updated with the most recent information regarding the U.S. occupation and what it's meant, because that topic is still considered too sensitive. So Iraqi school children today don't have any chapters in their history books about the invasion and occupation of Iraq.
You've cited a lot of projects that never really got completed, mm-hmm. but the money was allocated to complete mm-hmm. it. So what happened to that money when there was a gap between what was allocated and what was actually done?
The contractor walked away with that money. The contractor gets paid whether or not the project, at least in Iraq, the contractors have been paid whether or not the projects have been completed. And they're often given bonuses as well. The excuse is that Iraq was a tough place to work. It was unlike any other contracting job in the world. And so even if Bechtel and Halliburton and Parsons weren't able to finish the work, they got paid for what they did. And anything that was left over, and there often wasn't anything left over, could be used to complete the project. That hasn't happened very often. The money has just run out.
My guest is T. Christian Miller. His new book is called Blood Money. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is T. Christian Miller. He's an investigative reporter for the Los Angeles Times and author of the new book, Blood Money, Wasted Billions, Lost Lives, and Corporate Greed in Iraq, and it's about the reconstruction of Iraq. In reporting the story, how much of your work was looking through accounting books and how much of it was actually going to Iraq and looking at half-finished projects?
Well, it was a mix. That was what I thought I most enjoyed about my job, is that I was based in Washington, D.C., and so I got to hear the folks here in Washington talk about the reconstruction and the benefits it was bringing to Iraq. And then it was part of my job to go over on a routine basis. I went over 4 times in 2 years to basically truth squad what it was that was being said in Iraq, and to do that old-fashioned reporter's trick of following the money. And so I would listen in Washington, D.C. to what was being said, and I would go to Iraq, and I would just invariably discover the disconnect. It was just enormous. You would go to Iraq, and I would literally tell them, take me to your model, ideal, best project you have going on. And so they would, the Army Corps of Engineers or USAID or whoever, would take me out to a water plant. And you would arrive finally at the end of a long trail of money, taxpayer money and congressional dictates and policy decisions to a water plant, let's say, up in northern Iraq. And there would be equipment scattered around, and there would be water that was not functioning and maintenance that wasn't being done, and it was just obvious that there was a lot of money going to waste. It just was a factor of actually putting your feet on the ground and seeing the truth.
Was it hard to find people willing to talk about what's going on in the reconstruction of Iraq? Because from the way you describe it in the book, it sounds like a lot of people have a lot to cover up, a lot that they're not really proud of.
Yeah, I think One, there was a lot of sensitivity about how the reconstruction was perceived, and it remains to this day. It was a lot of hostility toward negative news. And there is, to be fair, certainly there have been successes in Iraq, and those tend not to be covered as much as the failures. But I think that's the same thing can be said for almost anything in the news media. But the other thing was that what I found most difficult, most challenging actually, was simply following the money trail. I can't think of any U.S. government program involving American taxpayer money that was more difficult to just simply figure out, okay, you passed this bill here, where is that money going for in Iraq? What is it buying? Partly that's a reflection of the chaos, and partly they say it's a reflection of security. So you or I today, or any taxpayer, if you were to go to the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers and say, show me a list of all the projects you've done, and they won't give you a list because they say, if we tell you that this school here was built in this place and it was done by the U.S. government, the Iraqis will blow it up, which I think more than anything else tells you how successful our hearts and mind effort has been. But you and I can't know, really, and you won't be told what exactly that money has gone for. So it was just a constant struggle to try and get out to a site, and it was always under tight restrictions. I was rarely able to identify where the site was or what it was called or who exactly was building it or what companies were involved. So there's just a hole of information, a black hole, where you just don't know what Iraqi firms were hired, who they were, where they worked. You don't know necessarily which American companies, what projects they were doing or working on. It's just a mystery. It's a black hole.
Is there a personal adventure you had in reporting the story of corporate greed and abuse in Iraq that reveals a larger story of the problem? A personal adventure that reveals part of the larger story?
Halliburton has been much maligned for wasting money in Iraq. But when you get to Iraq and you get on the ground, you find that Halliburton is made up of a lot of blue-collar people from middle America, truck drivers, cooks, people who couldn't make the American dream work in America because the jobs don't pay enough money, but who saw in Iraq an opportunity to make $100,000 a year, which is what they were getting paid. These folks are salt of the earth. And I rode with a convoy of truck drivers who were delivering supplies. And you find out that they get into these trucks, they're barreling across the most hostile landscape in the world, and they've got no armor in their cabs. And so I'm driving with these guys, they're just truck drivers, except they're in Iraq. And all of a sudden, ahead of me, about 1,000 yards or so, some insurgents just open fire on this convoy. And I suddenly realized at that moment, there is absolutely nothing I can do except, you know, squeeze myself into a space as small as possible and hope that my bulletproof vest works, because there's no armor in this cab. It's just going to get shot up if this firing continues. And luckily, the military escort who was with that particular convoy manages to return fire, and the insurgent either runs away or gets killed, and we continue on our way. But I realized that moment that in contracting out these sorts of jobs to ordinary civilians, contractors, guys who are trying to make a buck, the U.S. was basically able to hide the true cost of the war. We don't have to have as many soldiers as over there. We don't have to have as many casualties. And so it was a cheap way to conduct the war. And today you've got, I think, more than 500 contractors have now been killed in Iraq, and you never hear about those guys. If you add them to the death toll, it would be well over 3,000 people by now.
Somebody who you single out for praise in your book is Stuart Bowen, the Inspector General for Reconstruction in Iraq. What has been so good, do you think, about his performance in that position?
I think Bowen has surprised everyone. I think Bowen surprised, in a positive way, the Democrats, and in a negative way, some of the Republicans. Stuart Bowen was one of Bush's closest legal advisors. He worked with him in Texas and followed him to the White House here in Washington. He was appointed to be the Special Inspector General for the Reconstruction of Iraq. And I believe that he has surprised everyone in how aggressive he has been in revealing problems in the reconstruction of Iraq. Bowen himself says that what he does is real-time auditing. And unlike other auditors who will go to a project, review it, and then spend a year doing a report, he tries to get in there quickly and quickly alert government officials to the problems that he sees. And so he's rubbed a lot of people the wrong way because he has produced numerous audits, numerous reports which have shown problems. Laura Bush's hospital, he took that on and was the one who found out there were some accounting questions. Halliburton, he criticized Halliburton in the middle of an election year. So he has shown a stomach for taking on politically sensitive topics and delivering critical reports. And he's done that repeatedly.
Now, you've documented a lot of corporate greed and contracts given to corporations by Americans, but the work was finally either not done or not done well. Do you think that a lot of this work could have just gone to Iraqi companies and to Iraqi workers?
Yes, absolutely. And 3.5 years later, we're doing that finally. One of the greatest tragedies of the Reconstruction, in my opinion, is that we're giving up on it. The money runs out at the end of this month. The biggest chunk of money needs to all be contracted out by the 30th of September. And here we are, 3.5 years later. There's no more money in the pipeline for the Reconstruction of Iraq. This is at a time when we finally figured out that, you know, we can actually can send some money directly to the Iraqi firms. They can do a lot of this work. Yes, some of that money is still going to get wasted, but it will be wasted with Iraqi firms, and hopefully it will trickle down somewhere in the Iraqi economy. And so here we are. We've learned these lessons, and we're going to give up on it. To me, that just doesn't make sense. It takes away a tool that our soldiers, our diplomats, our public servants need in Iraq. And to not send more money, and I acknowledge a lot of it's been wasted and there's been fraud and abuse, but to give up on that effort now seems to me the final tragic mistake of the Reconstruction.
T. Christian Miller, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thanks so much for having me, Terry.
T. Christian Miller is an investigative reporter for the LA Times. His new book is called Blood Money. Coming up, classical music critic Lord Schwartz talks about his trip to New Mexico for the Santa Fe Opera's 50th summer season. This is Fresh Air. The Santa Fe Opera celebrated its 50th season this past summer, which makes it one of the longest-running opera companies in this country. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz spent the summer there 35 years ago. Over the summer, he went back again for the first time.
This summer, enticed by an exciting schedule of operas, including an important American premiere, I made a nostalgic return visit to the Santa Fe Opera. Back in 1971, I spent the whole summer there, visiting my girlfriend, who is part of Santa Fe's pioneering apprentice program, a program that gives gifted young singers a chance to work with established vocalists, directors, and coaches. The buzz that summer was about a young soprano from New Zealand with the unusual name Kiri Te Kanawa, who was making her American debut. But I actually got more involved with the company than I expected to. I helped paint sets. I did some acting. I played the guard who arrests the hero in Verdi's Don Carlo. And I ended up writing my first professional music review of one of Santa Fe Opera's world premieres. All ears and no threat, I listened to musicians joke about their experiences and worry about the precariousness of their careers. I didn't know it at the time, but that summer in Santa Fe had been a turning point in my life. Mostly what was new for me this summer was the spectacular high-tech open-air theater, which was built in 1998. There's probably no more beautiful spot on earth for opera than Santa Fe. When the back of the stage is open, you can see the lights of Los Alamos glittering in the distance. The old theater, with its two dramatically cantilevered roofs, also left a dramatic opening for rain. I remember sharing an umbrella during numerous performances. In the new production of The Tempest, by the young British composer Thomas Otis, an opera based on Shakespeare's play, unscheduled lightning flashed as if on cue, but no one except the shipwrecked characters got wet. The Santa Fe Opera has a brilliant record of American and world premieres. Audiences trust the company and fill the theater, even for new works. Otis, who is only 34, is the most impressive British opera composer to come along since Benjamin Britten. Otis's librettist, Meredith Oakes, follows Shakespeare's plot, but uses contemporary English and makes up new rhymes, which are not really an improvement on Shakespeare. I was especially taken with Otis's otherworldly, higher-than-human music for the sprite Ariel, sung by the phenomenal Cindy Acedon, who created this role in London 2 years ago. Here's Ariel obeying the orders of Rod Gilfrey's commanding Prospero. The Santa Fe 50th anniversary season was elegantly put together. The poet W.H. Auden considered the magic flute to be Mozart's version of The Tempest, so it was revealing to see these two operas back to back. The productions ranged from powerful and dazzling to silly. In The Magic Flute, I thought it was a terrible idea to alternate between sung German and spoken English, to mingle Elizabethan gowns and baseball caps, to have the villain dressed as a Nazi and the Queen of the Night's daughter, Pamina, look like Maria in West Side Story. But French soprano Nathalie Dessay, the latest in a long line of wonderful singers attracted to Santa Fe, made a ravishing and heartbreaking Pamina. At its best, the Santa Fe Opera can compete with the top opera companies in the world. With its commitment to new works, its apprentice programs, and its creative outreach, the company pioneered having translations flash on the back of the seat in front of you, and you can even choose English or Spanish. The company is making a concerted investment in the future of opera, which makes it one of the most vital arts institutions in this country.
Lloyd Schwartz is classical music editor of the Boston Phoenix and teaches English at the University of Massachusetts, Boston. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our senior producer is Roberta Shurrock. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Ian Chillog, Patty Leswing, Sam Brigger, and Jonathan Menjivar. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of Barnes & Noble Classics edition of Mary Shelley's Frankenstein, available in stores and online at bn.com. From the American Cancer Society Cancer Action Network, working to make cancer a national priority at Celebration on the Hill, details at acscan.org. And from Universal Pictures, presenting The Black Dahlia, from the director of Scarface and the author of L.A. Confidential, The Black Dahlia, in theaters Friday. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, this film is not yet rated. We'll talk with filmmaker Kirby Dick about his new documentary investigating the secretive MPAA rating system, which gives movies a G, PG, PG-13, R, or NC-17. And we'll hear from the head of the MPAA's ratings board. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.